discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover Napro technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Dr. Hilgers, in our previous segment, we talked about contraception, but only one aspect. We talked about the birth control pill, we talked about the patch, but there are so many other devices out there, both chemical and physical. And one of the devices that I've never understood why a woman would want to place it in their body is the IUD.
Well, the IUD stands for intrauterine device, and it has an interesting history, which is worthwhile maybe spending a couple minutes on, because believe it or not, the concept of the IUD came from the camels in Egypt who used to cross the Sahara Desert, and in order to keep them from getting pregnant, they would put a rock in their uterus.
Ugh.
And so physicians, hearing that and knowing that, decided that maybe you could devise a device to place inside the uterus. So, in the late 1920s, the first IUD was promoted and developed. And since then, I mean, there have been as many IUDs developed probably as you've got fingers and toes and ears and eyes to count.
Mm-hmm.
The intriguing thing about the IUD is two things, really. One is that in about 1958, Dr. Alan Guttmacher, who is the former president of Planned Parenthood in the United States, he's now deceased many years. He was an obstetrician gynecologist. He wrote a textbook, a medical textbook, on obstetrics and gynecology. And in that textbook, he said about the intrauterine device that putting the intrauterine device inside the uterus is tantamount to malpractice.
Mm.
That was almost a quote. And he did use the word malpractice for certain. Well, then he went to India and did one of these little quick tours of India. And he saw these communities which were jam-packed with people. And he decided the world was overpopulated. And the only way we're going to ever control the population was to implement strategies which were motivation independent. In other words, you didn't have to be motivated to use them. And he thought the IUD was perfect because you could put it in. The woman wouldn't get pregnant. She didn't have to have any motivation. Her spouse didn't have any motivation. And they could remove it and she'd be fertile again. So it was reversible. Incidentally, that whole idea of not being motivated is one of the mantras of the birth control movement. They really honestly believe, or at least they try to sell the idea that they believe, that human beings cannot be sufficiently motivated to what they would call control their sexual urges, what we might call develop a self-mastery of your body and your emotions and submit your passions to reason of some sort. They don't think that can be done. And it has been carried through to the present day when Planned Parenthood says teenagers are going to have sex no matter what you do, so make sure you give them contraception. So that's one of the things that the IUD really played a lot on. Now, the other part of it was that in the early 1960s, there were a whole series of international conferences held, sponsored to some extent by Planned Parenthood and others, with regard to the intrauterine device, because when Guttmacher came back, he became involved in the Population Council, which is a big group out in New York City, which incidentally was behind the development of RU486 more recently. So all of a sudden, he took what he thought was malpractice and decided to promote the heck out of it. And became a major contraceptive agent. But it had a big hurdle to overcome, and that is, many people thought that it was abortive. And so they had these international conferences. They were talking about the idea that it was abortive. And if it got labeled as an abortive agent, it would not be well received at all in these developing countries, such as India and Pakistan and the various countries over there that they were trying to control the population. So it was in those conferences that they decided to redefine the beginning of pregnancy. And instead of conception, meaning the moment of fertilization, conception was now meant to be from implantation forward. Oh. So if the intrauterine device interrupted implantation, sort of before implantation, it couldn't be abortive. That was the whole rationale behind it. Mm-hmm. So that, as you know, many of the medical dictionaries now have redefined conception to begin, by definition, to be at the time of implantation. Of course, it's completely wrong. It's utterly false biologically. Mm-hmm. But this is how things get changed subtly, and you change a whole profession, you change a whole view, you change a whole outlook on these things, and you do it by deception, really. And so the IUD was really the first device, first birth control program, where there was a need to redefine pregnancy, and the motive, of course, was to remove the label of it being abortive. Of course, then since that time, regardless of all of that, it had so many side effects that one after another of the IUDs got pulled from the market because of massive litigation, malpractice suits, and so forth, women dying as a result of their use, and so forth. So today, the IUD in the United States, at least, is not used on a very large scale. But there are still some IUDs that are currently on the market, mostly the ones that have a progesterone in the core of the IUD, and that renders the line of the uterus incapable of implantation. But it's very expensive, so it's not used very much anymore. But there was a time when it was used extensively, but not as much anymore.
It is a means that is, in essence, then abortifacient. I mean, that's how it works. It prevents... Help me out.
Well, you could call it an early embryo, probably, but there are different biological names, but it's the beginning of a new life. And it is abortifacient, at least... Its primary mechanism of action is abortifacient or abortive. And when I was in my training at the Mayo Clinic, I wrote a paper on the intrauterine device and its mechanism of action, specifically that. And at the time, it was sort of interesting because, and this raises a kind of a controversial issue within the pro-life effort, incidentally, I raised the dilemma that the intrauterine device, based on all of my review of studies done in humans, that it was predominantly an abortive device. And while I was sort of a rising young doctor in the pro-life movement, all of a sudden I was persona non grata because there are many doctors in the pro-life movement who were putting in the IUD.
Oh, my.
And now this goes back to the 1960s and 70s, but still, I raised that sort of awful spectrum that some of these contraceptive agents really weren't so contraceptive after all. And it really created some difficulties and problems. And I'd say to this day, the pro-life movement as a whole hasn't really dealt with this very well. And the Planned Parenthood people, actually, they use it against us a lot. I mean, they will say, well, people aren't concerned about when they take the birth control pill, that they're not very considered, they don't care if there's an IUD, that if they want to make abortion illegal, what are they going to do about that? And there's a lot of that sort of stuff that's happened. And the pro-life movement's... They need to look at this a lot more seriously.
It really is a word game because when you really break it apart, contraception is a prevention of conception.
That's correct.
But something that affects that life that is conceived, that conception has occurred, then its action of aborting that is no longer contra. I mean, it hasn't prevented the conception.
Right, exactly. Contraception is the prevention of conception. That's absolutely correct. And in fact, early in the days with the IUD, they tried to change the name of it to an intrauterine contraceptive device, IUCD. And that didn't take off very well. But the idea was to get that label in there so it would not be labeled an abortive device, but it could never really escape that potential. So
I think that's the thing that's been so hard for women to understand or appreciate, is because they think they're preventing conception. And really, in so many of the cases that you've discussed with us, conception does occur.
Yes.
A life has begun. And the actions that either these chemicals or these devices, they are in essence, the only way to eliminate it is to abort it out of your body.
Yeah.
It's an ugly word, but it's the action that's occurring.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it is really tragic. And the word game you mentioned, that's part of the deception that I keep referring to. They try to use words that try to camouflage it. You see, I think that's as evil, if I can use that word,
mm-hmm.
almost as evil as the actual device themselves and what they do, because we're talking about a profession that's educated,
mm-hmm.
that is supposed to be propelled by certain ethical principles, but they're not sharing the truth with people. And that really gets to the core of how you trust a profession, how you work within that profession as a patient, as a recipient of their services. So how can you trust them on other things that they might tell you? And it actually does have an impact. In fact, one of the things I'm kind of working on right now is the impact that the use of contraceptive agents, and abortion for that matter, has had now on medical decision-making in other areas. As I said with our last half hour, we've accepted the notion now that you can treat something that's actually normal and healthy, a normal physiologic part of who we are, as if it were a disease. As soon as you make that leap, and that's no longer a problem, then you can accept the abortion of very early life. Then you can accept its expansion into services such as abortion, such as all of the artificial reproductive technologies, which are abortive in their nature, also at the same time during the pregnancy. Well, then, of course, in the more modern era, the last 5 years or so, we're talking about embryo experimentation, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, and all of these things, all of which deal with the very earliest of the stages of human development. Once you've gone through that process of accepting those things, then it just opens up the whole door. And years ago, people would say, well, this opens up the slippery slope. It's like a Pandora's box. And they go, well, it doesn't do that. You know, they always say, well, there's no slippery slope here. Can't happen. No, nothing. You're just making, you're an alarmist. We have control of what we're doing, and that's not going to happen. But it's happened.
That's right.
We're now at the stage where it has happened. And it's going to continue to happen. We know, I mean, because the ethical principles that have been laid down, I mean, if you're going to continue to be consistent with that, you've got to accept experimentation with embryos. You've got to accept cloning. You've got to accept embryonic stem cell research. You've got to accept all these things because you've already accepted it in other areas.
That's right.
So it would be, you have to accept a different method, a different ethic. Of course, that's what we would like to see. Because there's so much more value in a life-affirming ethic than there is in this life-destructive ethic.
We'll return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers in just a moment.
England may be reconsidering the emotional toll of abortion.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
On February 1st, 2007, a day before her 31st birthday, a British artist named Emma Beck hanged herself. In her suicide note, she bemoaned aborting her unborn twins, saying, "I died when my babies died." Her story, which was recently reported after a year-long investigation, has shaken England. In response, England's Royal College of Psychiatrists announced that women should not be allowed to have an abortion until they're informed of the risks the procedure poses to their mental health. Pro-Life Britons hope Parliament will enact the recommendation to help prevent such tragedies.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This is the Pope Paul VI Institute Minute with Dr. Tom Hilgers.
The Church spoke directly to me in the challenges of Humanae Vitae. My personal and professional life were changed forever. One physician in the book Physicians Healed wrote, quote, "Humanae Vitae made so much sense, I committed myself to cease providing contraceptive service and to promote natural family planning." This book has received numerous other testimonies that read like this one about the lives and practices being changed because of the truth of Humanae Vitae. The next generation of physicians who have accepted Humanae Vitae and have discovered NAPR technology are making the decision to dedicate their professional career to science that cooperates with natural regulation of fertility. They will not make the same mistakes as my generation, which accepted the birth control pill as a cover-all symptoms measure. The commitment of these new physicians is truly inspiring. Until next time, I'm Dr. Tom Hilgers.
for a complimentary gift and more information on the Pope Paul VI Institute, log on to www.popepaul6.com.
A teaching of St. Paul from his first letter to the Thessalonians. We exhort you, brethren, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. See that none of you repays evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to all. Rejoice always, pray constantly, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you.
Spirit Catholic Radio presents Faith Check. Here's Greg Ewell.
The celebrated English convert John Henry Cardinal Newman pointed out that the Catholic Church can be likened to a tiny acorn which grows into a tree. Though it looks entirely different, it remains in its essence the same thing. Likewise, a human being grows from a tiny child to an adolescent through adulthood to old age, and he remains the same person with the same DNA. So too, the Church grows and develops as the living body of Christ. Of course, the church of over 1 billion people today is not a mirror image of the relatively tiny church in the first century Mediterranean that we read about in the New Testament, nor should it be. The church's organization and outward forms are dynamic, not static, and must change to meet the needs of the age. Yet the church remains the same church, believing the same faith. The church's doctrine also grows and develops, never contradicting itself, but deepening with years of reflection and clarification. For instance, it was not until Christ's divinity was denied that the Nicene Council gave us the creed we profess each Sunday at Mass, which states precisely what we do and do not believe about our Lord. And so grows the Church until the consummation of time. This is Greg Ewell for Faith Check.
We now return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. There is no money to be made in a regulation that requires just your mind, your heart, your soul, and to watch and monitor your own body. But there is plenty of money to be made in chemicals, devices, all different types of levels of those devices. And I can understand the motivation. As a human, I understand the motivation of a drug company because they're looking for that profit. But as you have stated, I don't understand the motivation of someone who has taken the oath to heal and to help, and to keep life sustained.
Well, you almost think they have a schizophrenic death wish in their own profession, because you deliver a baby one day and you tie her tubes the next day, mm-hmm. so she can't have any more babies. And it's sort of a schizophrenic approach to the care of pregnant women and to the delivering of their babies, and all of a sudden they don't have any babies anymore. And I don't know, the whole thing doesn't make sense, to me at least.
It doesn't. And now we have drugs and treatments that are just out and out abortifacients. The first thing that comes to my mind is the morning after pill.
The morning after pill is a high concentration of the same hormones that are present in the oral contraceptive. The idea is the couple has intercourse, and the next day or the day after, regardless of what may be happening in her body, she takes this high dose of this medicine. And there may be times if it's taken pre-ovulatory where it may inhibit ovulation and be contraceptive, but there's obviously times also when its main mechanism would be an abortive one. And so the tragedy here is that there have been these debates at the level of the Food and Drug Advisory Committee about whether it should be made an over-the-counter medication, and my understanding is that it has been recently approved for over-the-counter use, and I don't know that it's available quite yet, but it will be shortly. And so what's going to happen? To me, these are disasters waiting to happen. And what I think is going to happen is you're going to have a teenager who gets pregnant, or maybe not even know she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. She runs to the drugstore, gets the morning after pill. Maybe she's like 4 weeks pregnant, just early in the stages of pregnancy, but right at the stage of all the organ development of this baby. She doesn't know the difference of what's happening. She gets this over-the-counter. She takes the medication. The baby's born with some sort of a significant congenital defect, a teratogenic defect, a defect related to the medication she's taken. Mm-hmm. And you've done enormous damage to this developing baby. And, of course, that's going to lead to lawsuits and all this other stuff in the usual American way. And it'll eventually get thrown off, just as other products have gotten thrown off the market, like the intrauterine devices, the Dalkon Shield, for example, years ago, and many others since then.
Mm-hmm.
And RU486, which is being threatened by lawsuits right now, that's the abortion pill specifically, which is a medication that's designed to abort a pregnancy up to about the 49th day of pregnancy. It's a pill which inhibits the production and the application of the hormone progesterone, which is the main hormone that helps support pregnancy, so a miscarriage occurs to a certain degree. But actually, just in the last year or so, there's been a rash of deaths, maternal deaths related to RU46. And they've been published, and people are aware of them, and it's been brought to the Food and Drug Administration's attention, but they've said, well, it's not enough evidence that, we should pull it from the market yet. But it's going to happen. It will not stay on the market, I would predict. It's another one of these things which I like to use the term. It's a disaster waiting to happen. And I think that's what's going to happen with RU46 as well.
And both are being marketed as conveniences for women. That's something that's good for women. But how can something that does so much trauma to your body and to your system be good for women?
Well, of course, it isn't good for women.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, but it gets back in a way to this thing that I was talking about a moment ago about the lack of motivation. They believe everybody has this, like rabbits maybe. We're propelled by sexual feelings and emotions that once they start, I call it the domino theory of human sexuality. That once it gets started, it's like a set of dominoes, and it concludes always with the act of intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's no way to intervene in any of that just based on reason, on willpower, on our ability to interact between people, man and woman.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way to do that. That's almost an accepted premise of the Planned Parenthood approach. And yet, there's no evidence that that is the case. There's no medical evidence that that's true. In fact, our own experience, and we have the largest experience, and I don't mean us ourselves, but any of the people involved in the natural family planning movement have the experience that this not only is possible, but it's done all the time, and couples do it all the time, and they get along just magnificently. In fact, their relationships build and get stronger as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we see because of the type of work we're involved in. Planned Parenthood will never see that, because they're not involved in this side of the equation. So they're promoting, and they've got billions of dollars to promote, which is another issue which is devastating to our whole sort of sexual economy, if you will. I mean, it's just horrible what we have to put up with all the money that they've got to promote their concepts, their ideology, because it is an ideology. It's a form of social liberalism. I think that I'm going to write a book someday. It's going to be entitled Social Liberalism Needs to Be Defeated.
Yes.
I mean, it's like communism needs to be defeated. Mm-hmm. Well, social liberalism needs to be defeated because it is that harmful to people. All of this stuff about how Planned Parenthood, and I just use Planned Parenthood sort of figuratively because it's Planned Parenthood and all those people who follow their ideology.
That's right.
Have been promoting this and really shoving it down everybody's throat for far too long, and it's been devastating. So we got to get this whole issue of motivation and really show people that young people can subject their passions and their emotions to the reasonable outcome of how they think about things, what their values are, and so forth. And there have been some studies now to show that if a young person believes the value that having intercourse prior to marriage is not healthy for the relationship, if they believe that, the incidence of out-of-wedlock pregnancies and out-of-wedlock sexual activity is very, very low. If you take the other group, which has the Planned Parenthood mantra of this is all good and fine, the sexual activity is very high and, of course, all the litany of things that go with it. So we need more research, of course, along those lines, but there's beginning research to show this, and we need to expose that research. We need to make sure that people are aware of it and get the message out to more and more people. And then, of course, we have to teach our young people that they can do this, that we believe in them to do this, and that it isn't something that we shouldn't sort of hesitate with them. You know, one of the things that I've told people a lot is they say that 50 to 60% of young people will engage in intercourse before they graduate from high school or first year of college, maybe something in that range.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say that the story really isn't in the 50 or 60% of the people who are having intercourse, young people I'm talking about, outside of marriage. It's the 40 or 50% who aren't having intercourse that's the story.
That's right.
When they are inundated with everything they see, from the commercials at the Super Bowl to television programs and movies, and it just goes on and on and on and on. You get in an elevator with a young woman, and by the time you get to the fifth floor, you've had intercourse and you're all rumpled and back together again. I mean, there's commercials on television that convey that mentality.
Right.
The real miracle is how have these young people survived that? Because there's not enough support for them. But somewhere in their heart, somewhere in their being, in their soul, in their way of looking at things, they've been able to live a life which hasn't bought that sort of hook, line, and sinker attitude or thought. And I think that's a huge area to look at, because I'm sure we can learn a lot from those young people and the struggles maybe they have gone through, but also how they've coped with it and how they've understood how to go beyond it.
Well, I'm glad you're out there. And also, Dr. Thomas Hilger, is that the Pope Paul VI Institute is out there trying to educate and support women, men, children, and families, and sending out a message that is not supported by big money and big finance, an industry that is counting on this type of behavior to be able to support itself. I'm just glad that the Pope Paul VI Institute is heeding those prophetic words of Pope Paul VI to rise to the higher things.
Well, I'm glad it's there too, actually. Well, you know, when you think about it over the years and our own involvement with it, you'd think that it was one of these kind of lost causes, because first of all, everybody rejected Humana Vitae. So then here we come along and say, well, gee, I think we're going to build an institute, name it after Pope Paul VI, you know, this kind of loser guy over here that everybody kind of thinks of him. And so it's like totally an impossible task. But the things we've learned and the things we've understood better as a result of this are just incredible. It's a little miracle all of its own. And so we're just honored to be a part of it. And it gets back to this whole thing, you know, you put effort into these things and there's so much more that comes out of it that's good, that you would never anticipate than all of the whatever heartache or difficulties might be there. The rewards are much better.
Well, as of the prophets of old, you, I think, serve in good company out in the wilderness, a voice crying out, say, everybody listen. Now, come on, educate. And for you to take your time out of a very, very busy work schedule to share it with us today is so greatly appreciated.
Well, thanks, Chris. It's been great as always.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Hilgers and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers.